I'd like to introduce Susan McGarry, and of course she needs, as they say so often, no introduction. She's something of an icon in women's studies, a well-known historian, a writer, a lecturer. She's played a role in publishing in this country and in others. She has been instrumental in putting women's studies on the map and has been on the editorial boards of a range of journals in the United Kingdom, Canada, and has been really significantly recognised as a leader in her field. Many of you will have read books that are not on gender issues, surprisingly enough. I suspect some of you have read her book on Roma Mitchell, or even the Queen Adelaide Club. And these biographies are significant historical works as well. So may I introduce Susan to you this evening and welcome her to the lectern.
All right. I wanted to echo your recognition of the First Nations custodians of the land that we meet on. I wanted also, since I don't expect to be doing this again, to thank Ray and Paul and Edwina, who's on her way to Portugal, I understand, and Jane Morphy, who's off somewhere else as well. And I realised when I was sitting, I was thanking everybody. I realised when I was sitting out this evening that I've been coming to this library to read probably longer than almost anybody else here. I've been coming to this library to read since 1961, which means it's more than half a century. Which means this library is a very precious place for me, and most of the most important things that I ever learned, I learned here, not all. So I also just want to do honour to the Bath Smith Library and its books and collections and all the things that it does for students. Okay, now I'm talking to the title. I'm talking to the title, Stitching a Story Towards a History of Women's Liberation in Australia, and I'll begin by explaining why it's only towards. So here and now, it's March 2015, I received an email from a schoolgirl presenting me with a question about feminism for her Year 12 project. To what extent, she asked, do you believe that the feminist movement has been successful? Feminism is, no doubt, an integral part of our daily lives. During the previous week, the E! Newspaper called The Conversation published a short piece on gender-neutral language. In celebration of International Women's Day, ABC TV's Q&A program guest-hosted by popular political journalist Annabelle Crabb, author of The Wife Drive, had an all-woman panel, which included Germaine Greer, Foreign Minister Judy Bishop, and visiting United States author, academic and columnist Roxane Gay. A good friend emailed me to say that they were celebrating the 40th anniversary of the establishment of a women's refuge, named after Beryl Henderson, founding participant in Canberra Women's Liberation. This year's Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras in Sydney is broadcast on SBS, and one of its two hosts is wonderful comic actor Magda Zabansky. Former supermodel Tara Moss has just published a book in which she declares herself a feminist. Tanya Plibersek, deputy leader of the federal opposition, declares herself a feminist. Late last year, Sex Discrimination Commissioner Elizabeth Broderick was named Australia's most influential woman. My email brings me reports from the South Australian Equal Opportunity Commission. There are reports from the Women's Information Service in Adelaide. It's now sharing an office with the South Australian Government Office for Women. A month after all this, the University of Adelaide launched the Dawn World Framework, announcing, and I'm quoting them, "We have a moral imperative to to improve our staff gender balance. This is 2015. I've been here since 1983 trying to do something about that. Could such a list be testimony to the success of the feminist movement? Well, yes, it's certainly not evidence of its failure. But also no, not if that's all I sent her, for there's still an awful lot that needs to change. My folder of current events holds an article from the Sydney Morning Herald, again from March, headed Gender Pay Gap Hits 20-Year High, Leaving Women's Wages Up to 20 Years Behind. A month later, I add to it another article reporting that women need to work for an extra 15 years until the age of 74, which is actually older than I am now, to retire with the same superannuation balances as men. Annabel Crabb's book is an extended argument that the paucity of women in senior positions in any kind of organisation is a result of women undertaking the bulk of the caring work that enables the other half of the domestic partnership to take on the requirements of any kind of job in the labour market. Journalist Gabrielle Jackson responded to the Crabb-hosted Q&A, criticising it for its narrow focus on a few pre-approved liberal feminist issues, those are her words, and such matters as how much hair women remove from their bodies. She could also have noted that Deputy Prime Minister Julie Bishop, one of only two female members of the federal government, refuses to call herself a feminist. A recent issue of the Adelaide Review noted that racehorses appear in the media more often than sporting women. The Beryl Refuge is still a necessity. Australia's National Research Organisation for Women's Safety reports that domestic, these are their words, domestic and sexual violence is overwhelmingly committed by men against women. And then it goes on, this is chilling. 89 women were killed by their current or former partner between 2008 and 2010. This, they observe, equates to nearly one every week. The schoolgirl's request for information of views about the feminist movement asks for significant changes over the past 60 years. That means since 1955. Now that's a year before television began broadcasting in Australia, a time when I was still in school, being taught that my primary goal in life should be marriage and service to my breadwinning husband. A time well before anything that could be called a feminist movement began. Moreover, asking if the feminist movement has been successful means that it's over now. Well, I conclude that this means that I was right all those years ago when I resolved that it was high time for a history of the women's liberation movement in Australia. Now, all those years ago, it was 1994, the centenary of the passage of the first Australian legislation giving women the right to vote and to sit in Parliament, a provision which made this legislation first in the world. I thought the centenary an opportune moment for an application to the Australian Research Council for funds to work towards a history of the women's liberation movement. And we did get a sizeable grant, but that history is not being written. Or at least not yet. However, I have made a start, and the book that I'm talking about this evening draws on that start. Okay, now I've already taken more time than I meant. I'll talk only about women's liberation. Indeed, I will talk only about the beginnings of women's liberation, and even that's a pretty big topic. So I've divided it up into three sections. As you can see, they've got subheadings. So let's begin with sources. Accounts of the women's liberation movement, the accounts of the sources of the women's liberation movement in Australia vary quite widely. Anne Curthoys holds that it began in radical left, new left politics, The early women's liberation movement, she argues, while in part a revolt against New Left men, was nevertheless imbued with New Left politics. It was concerned with imperialism, socialism, and the oppression of third world and minority groups, with ideologies sustaining an evil capitalist system, with revolutionary strategy and tactics. Another account emphasises how women of the post-World War II baby boom gained access to tertiary education in far greater numbers than ever before, learning about societies absolutely different in time, place, or kinds of relationship from our own, and thence being able to envisage changes to our own. That was actually Sarah Dulles. Susan Ryan, in New York, with her diplomat husband and two children, was already restless with her marriage. And these are her words. She seized upon the female eunuch, written in a brilliant explosion of frustration by Germaine Greer, our old acquaintance from St. Joseph's, Camperdown, and on Betty Friedan, Kate Manette, and Gloria Steinem, and they provided more grist to my mill, she wrote. All the intelligent women I met, my new neighbour, other Australians in town, university women, even some other wives of diplomats, were all on fire with enthusiasm. And yet other women explained the eruption of women's liberation by speaking of the exhilaration of discovering friendships with women, and even sometimes love, the bonding which brought solidarity to such a diverse array of women, at least now and again. Okay, Made in America. Now, I'm going to tell you two stories, and I'm going to read them to you. So if you can't tell me, shout. If you can't hear me, shout. Okay. The first one, it's 1969. Martha Ann Sarah, an American, was in her early 20s, living in Boston with her three-year-old son and splitting up with her husband. It was a big year for Martha. She moved first to California with her new Australian boyfriend and then, with the same bloke, to Australia. In Sydney, she made left-wing friends through Bob Gould's Third World Bookshop, in particular with Sandra Hawker and with two Australians who'd recently returned from the United States, Margaret Edith and Cooney Sanford. Together, they formed a group and discussed the pamphlets that Martha had brought with her and their own experiences. Towards the end of that year, they decided to hold an open meeting about women's liberation. Now, the official story is that those three women composed a leaflet headed, "Only the Chains Have Changed," to distribute during a protest march against the war in Vietnam on the 14th of December 1969 and calling a meeting about women's liberation for January 1970. Many years later, indeed not until we interviewed her, Martha confessed that being a young mother, she'd been exhausted and had fallen asleep. So the leaflet was the work of Sandra Hawker and Cooney Sanford and Martha and Sarah's filmmaking journalist boyfriend, Chris Till. The meeting should have been a failure, Martha said. Nobody in their right mind holds meetings in January. I knew nothing, you know. But even though it was January, when everyone goes to the beach and wants to go to meetings, this meeting was packed. This was, Martha and Sarah remembered, a new phenomenon. We were swept up, I guess, in a new sort of new wave of interest in this important phenomenon. So now, let us move across the country. Back, we're still in the same year, but a bit earlier. Early in 1969, Laura Osmond, a tutor in politics at the University of Adelaide, had been reading anti-war publications which made a great fuss over the Miss America protest of the 7th of September, 1968. New York radical women organised about 100 women onto buses to travel to Atlantic City, where they picketed the Miss America pageant, performed guerrilla theatre on the boardwalk, and tossed, this is a quote, instruments of torture to women, high-heeled shoes, bras, girdles, typing books, curlers, false eyelashes, and copies of Playboy, Cosmopolitan, and Ladies Home Journal, which I remember being proud of, into the Freedom trash can. But just for the record, they didn't, in spite of the endlessly reiterated myth, burn any of these objects, not even the bras. The city prohibited burning because the boardwalk was flammable. In an article published in the student newspaper on D, Warren Osmond drew a parallel between the Miss America pageant and Adelaide University's Miss Fresher beauty contest, part of the orientation week festivities at the beginning of the academic year. Was it not, he asked, just about time for a new feminism? Well, it took a while. So it was a year later, in March 1970. A group of about 50 young women, calling themselves Women's Liberation, picketed the Miss Fresher contest at Adelaide University. It got right up the nose of my younger sister. Anna Yateman, another politics tutor, said that they were protesting against being seen simply as objects of male desire, sex slaves, to be gaped at by pathetic, gobbling men. The media, briefly, went into a frenzy. Channel 9's newsreader interviewed Anna Yateman on television, and the evening newspaper, The News, with uncharacteristic prescience, headed its report, "Women's liberation is quickly shaping as a major world issue of the 1970s. Well, I got it right. So women's liberation made in America had arrived in Australia. But I will go to strategies. And the first of these was small group egalitarianism. Women's liberation groups mushroomed all over the country. Women's liberation quickly developed a characteristic approach to meetings, participants breaking up into small groups, sometimes they were called rep groups, which promoted an openness and width of participation impossible in large numbers. Such an approach, the New Sydney feminist paper, Lee Jane, claimed, enabled, and I'm quoting them, industrial workers, housewives, teachers, students, all women, to accept and relate to each other. What was most important was that they were relating as equals. Indeed, in one small group at a conference in Melbourne in 1971, the housewives, who were traditionally dismissed by the left as at best a reserve army of labour, the housewives demonstrated a sophisticated appreciation of their own political potential and its wider implication that made some of the early feminist theorists, who were usually considered the elite, made them sound narrow and naive. Now here I'm quoting this report from Nijan. They discussed the potential power of housewives as consumers to support the sisters in industry. When women workers make it known that a certain company exploits its female staff even more unmercifully than the average, housewives can stop buying the company's products. Now, such action needn't take on the proportion of an organised national boycott to have a pinprick effect on the company and to let the women in industry feel bolstered by the support. And I did subsequently hear a version of this strategy promoted at the United Nations Convocation on Women in China in 1995. Small groups of women committed to equality among all the participants were necessary for women to develop self-confidence. This, we were learning, was not possible in groups of women and men together. Men were accustomed to dominating proceedings, discussion, taking up all the space on the airwaves, exercising what, at the time, we called male supremacy, exerting power, however unthinkingly. I recall a bloke, he was a really nice husband. He was really totally on our side. He came to one of our meetings, it was about this high, and he had a strategy for dealing with being that high. He stood in the doorway with his arm up the door frame like that, so he looked taller. And there we all were sitting on the floor, as we usually did, and he was holding forth helpfully, supportively, on what we should do. Women's Liberation was developing a commitment to relationships between people that didn't accept differences in power. Politics, we argued, were as present in personal relationships as in parliaments and governments. So Women's Liberation banished the men from their gatherings, kept their groups small, and refused any kind of hierarchy within them. We were, and Summers explained, anti-organisation, in the sense that we have no elected officers, no formal membership, no rules or platform to which people must adhere, and no theories determining the relationship of factions or opposition groups to the movement as a whole. You can see the gap between what we were doing and what was happening in the Labour Party and on the left. Okay, consciousness raising. Now, a great many of the small women's liberation groups springing up around Australia included consciousness raising in their discussions. And I have to say, I have all this from reading. I didn't dare go near a consciousness raising group. Martha and Sarah described this process. We formed a group and we followed this consciousness raising procedure and we discussed our own lives. Jean Taylor in Melbourne reported, these are her words, consciousness raising is conducted in small groups of women, numbering from about 6 to 10 members. A topic is chosen, and each woman in the group gives testimony from her personal experience on this topic. A group in Carlton noted that topics like chastity or virginity got short shrift, but security went on for weeks and led to games people played, to friends, to loneliness. And there were also family relationships and sexuality. In consciousness-raising groups, participants learned that an isolated problem or an individual misery was neither isolated nor individual. Rather, each was a feature of a structural or systemic organisation of relations of power. And as American feminist Linda Gordon observed, once people do connect deeply felt personal problems to larger political structures, they often go on to make political sense out of the whole society rather quickly. To reach such perceptions, the women in any group had to learn to trust each other with narratives about themselves, about moments in their lives that they thought they would never describe to anyone, about aspects of their relationship with their mothers, fathers, husbands, lovers, daughters, brothers, sons, relationships that they had never thought to articulate, much less share. A trust of this order formed strong bonds, and with this came sisterhood. We call on all our sisters to unite with us in struggle, all our sisters to unite with us in struggle. This was the manifesto of Red Stockings, the group that Shulamith Firestone and Ellen Lewis founded in New York in 1969. Sisterhood is powerful, announced Robin Morgan's collection of articles, conceived of as an action by feminists committed to a women's revolution, and that was published in 1970. Across the Pacific in Australia, women read these words, adopted the concept, felt themselves united, and accordingly powerful. It was a transformation. Deborah McCulloch, women's advisor to Don Dunstan, observed that before the women's liberation movement, I'll quote Deborah, most of my contemporaries grew up with a culture which said, you don't spend any time with women, you don't like women, you always complained about them, and the ideal and the norm was male. Anne Summers wrote of the fading, and I'm quoting her, our traditional instilled competitiveness with, and even dislike of most other women, and how we were learning now to value and appreciate each other. Now it was different. The concept of sisterhood became the theory of unity, wrote Sylvia McKinney. Okay, the media. Melbourne feminist, this is the exhilaration bit, Melbourne feminist Sue Jackson described it like this. Now, I won't read it out to you. You can read faster than I can. Joy and power from working together was a powerful mix. The bonding was like with the women's movement forever, recalled Adelaide feminist Anne Dunn. I embraced the women's liberation movement like a lover, said Polish-born 50-year-old Rose Stone. We knew that the whole society had to change, said Sue Jackson. The amazing thing is, we thought it would happen. This was, Australian-born Lynn Siegel in England observed, the feminist dream of a common language, of shared values or goals. This was a politics of affinity. The fabric of the whole social order quivered. But of course there were problems with all of this, and other problems were to develop with time. I don't want to talk about these now. You will find them discussed in the book, should you care to pursue them. What I want to do instead is to conclude with some manifestations of that exhilaration, and that is women behaving badly. It was one of the wonderful things, of course, about this period of time. We behaved very badly indeed. Anne Summers walked about the Adelaide University campus pinning on trees copies of a wonderful article by North American Anne Coate. Offended engineering students followed her, ripping them off. The article, they were very offended, the article was called The Myth of the Vaginal Orgasm. Robin Archer walked onto the stage of the Union Hall at Adelaide University with her guitar, sat down and played a song that she composed called The Menstruation Blues. Women broadcasters formed a collective and launched the Coming Out Ready or Not show on International Women's Day 1975. This was on the ABC, no less. Two of them, Judy Rigg and Judy Copeland, had noted that new tone we can hear in women's voices, a boldness and enthusiasm for possibilities of change. About a year later, 79-year-old feminist, walking into Canberra Women's Liberation and saying, I've been waiting for you young women all my life. Well, she walked into, about a year later, she was 79, she was about to go off to Israel and get married the next year.
For the first time, I might say.
Anyway, here she is in Canberra, broadcasting on the ABC, on the Coming Out show, and she made what were called some passing remarks about etymology on that show. The radio manager decreed that what she said was offensive and prohibited the customary replay on regional networks. The Women's Broadcasting Cooperative responded with charges of censorship, as you would, and what was then broadcast was not some substitute program of music, which is what would normally happen, but 5 minutes of what broadcasters called tone, you know, that sort of noise, to signal that what was supposed to be there was not. Now, here, Beryl's words that so upset the radio manager. Imagine, she had a Lincolnshire accent.
In those days.
And then to conclude with a slightly grimmer moment, not quite. The RSL in Canberra persuaded the local government that women marching on Anzac Day to protest against the rape of women in war would be such bad behaviour that the local government passed an ordinance forbidding us to appear on the streets and then arrested a number of us when we did. But other protests of this kind were less grim. And here I'm coming to you. In 2000, the year 2000, in response to the Howard government's decision to impose its new goods and services tax on tampons and sanitary napkins, feminists literally bombarded the entire federal cabinet with tampons and sanitary pads. Red Kate, menstrual avengers in Sydney, chanted, "Get your bleeding tax off our Tampax." And in Canberra, women wearing red scarves and t-shirts proclaimed, "I bleed and I vote." You might have seen just last week, actually, on the news, did you? Feminists mounting a similar protest on the green slopes outside the Commonwealth Parliament building. Thank you.
we can have bad behaviour.